survive, thrive, stay alive. It's time to get prepared with the Prepping Academy Podcast.
Wow, that song was loud. Huh. Hey, welcome to Prepping Academy. I'm Forrest. Tenderfoot is not here. It's a major holiday, and Tenderfoot and his family left the country. No, I don't know where they are, actually. But he's not with me this evening, but we do have a very special guest, an author named Stephen Bird. And we'll be he'll be coming up and calling in just a few minutes. Hey, the Prepping Academy is a podcast radio show. We try to do weekly broadcast. You can find us at preppingacademy.com. Prepping, PrePPing, academy.com. Preppingacademy.com. Hey, I do want to take a minute to thank all our listeners. It is amazing how many people are listening to us. It's more than four, okay? No, it's in the thousands, and it's just crazy. And we just think it's the going back and forth with Tenderfoot and myself, but also the content we're bringing. We're bringing some big-time authors. So we just appreciate you guys, and keep sending the emails, keep rating us on Apple and all the podcasts, so it will get our podcast up. And we also, tonight we're going to, before Stephen comes on, I'm going to play the conflicted card game by myself. I'm going to ask the question and answer it. And I randomly picked one, and I'm going to go with it. I kind of like it. So anyway, we do want to mention one of our sponsors. We would like to thank John Haynes of Retreat Realty. He's one of our corporate sponsors, has been for a few years. We'd like to encourage you to contact him if you have any real estate needs in the Western North Carolina mountains. John has 30 years of experience, specializing in bug out properties, homesteads, off the grid type properties. He understands security. He understands the, every aspect of what a prepper is looking for. Even keeping it from, there's ways you can buy property that your name never really gets out there. But he's been doing this for 30 years. He has properties from 1 acre to several hundred acres. He's a prepper himself, and the coolest thing is he's good friends with Bill Fortune, the author of One Second Author, and he also, John Haynes also lives in Black Mountain, North Carolina, so you can imagine, he knows what's going on. He could help you. Again, that's his company is RetreatRealty.net, RetreatRealty.net, and his number is 828-773-8090. And this Retreat Realty, that's John Haynes. Tell him the Prepping Academy sent you. But he's been a longtime sponsor of the Carolina Prepper Network and the ever since we started the Prepping Academy. And so just if you're looking for some property, let him help you out. Okay, so hey, we're still doing the contest. We're giving away 10 Sawyer mini water filters, 10 of them. To enter, go to preppingacademy.com and look for either the mailing list or the newsletter. I think it's called newsletter, and sign up for it. And we will pick 10 names and send out. Sawyer will actually mail them for me. That way I don't have to do the postage. But sign up. We don't spam you. But sign up and you'll be registered to win one of 10 Sawyer Water mini filters. which is cool. And our next prize next month or the month after is going to be huge. So anyway, yeah, do that. So the conflicted card I randomly picked, which is so funny because my friends will laugh when I read this. The conflicted card that just randomly came up. Now, this is out of the conflicted deck, conspiracy deck number 8. Conspiracy deck number 8. And the card is climate change real and why? That's the conflicted card. You know, here's my thought on it. And you know what? As you guys know, I give you my opinion and you can usually don't really care. But anyway, but the conflicted card is climate change real? And I say, I don't really care. I think it's a little both. I think the scientists have been lying. We have facts of that. I think there are some climate change things that are going on that's affecting the Earth. 100,000 years, maybe it would change the Earth. And I tell people, you know, we are responsible to keep the Earth, you know, good and clean. And I think it's a God responsibility to take care of Earth. But it should not become a religion. And I think currently climate change is a religion. And I also think that the end of the world, when I say end of the world, I'm not talking crap hits the fan. I'm talking the end of the world when it comes to revelation in the Bible is sooner than any effects we could cause on this earth for climate change. So do I think it's responsibility for us to keep the earth beautiful and clean? Yes. Am I worried about it? Not at all. Is it a religion? It is religion. Don't be a part of that religion. Do I think that the end of the world and revelations coming before the effects we see? Absolutely. That's my two cents. That's how I just answered the conflicted deck card. That was, again, the deck number 8 on conspiracy. So I guess they're saying climate change is a conspiracy. So that is awesome. Okay, everyone, I've been telling you guys that we actually have a special guest tonight. This special guest is an author. I've seen him and met him many times at shows like Prepper Camp, Heritage Life Skills, and I get the opportunity to interview him tonight without Tenderfoot. So Tenderfoot would so love to be here because Tenderfoot was a Navy corpsman as well, just like Stephen Bird. But tonight it's just me and Stephen. Stephen, are you here with us tonight?
Yep, I'm right here.
All right, he is. And so everyone knows this, listen to our podcast. I am learning the software. I need to spend more time, but I think we got it working tonight, so all is good. So, Stephen, where are you from? And it was great seeing you. You know, Heritage Life Skills, what was that, a month back? It was great seeing you guys, and it's always to get good to see the guys. You read their books, but where are you from? And tell us what's going on with you, and where are you what you're doing, and just tell us about yourself.
Well, just want to comment real quick on what you were saying while I was listening in right before I came on, where you talked about how climate change wasn't supposed to be a religion. Well, I think my own personal philosophy is that science in general, which is supposed to be a method of study, has became a religion. It's became sort of a political religion. And a lot of real things, like you're talking about how some things, involved with climate change may be true, may not be true, you know, whatever. They're being utilized in a way to push an objective on people, whether there's some correct data in there or not. And all the people that are following along are kind of looking at it as if science is a religion. Mm-hmm. Science is the ultimate answer. Well, science is supposed to be just a method of study. And that's where that all got.
Absolutely.
Sidetracked. But it shouldn't be a belief system. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there real quick.
No, dude, it's awesome when your caller agrees with you. So, yes, that's awesome.
But that's always been a mantra of mine personally. But anyway, back to your question. I'm originally from a little Appalachian coal town called Harlan, Kentucky, the place where TV show Justified was based on, and there's been a couple movies about the bloody Union battles they've had there. Bloody Harlan, I think, is one, and the Harlan County War is another. But from there, joined the Navy to kind of get out of there and see the world and make something of myself. Ended up out in the Seattle area for 13 years. And when I first got there in 1993, it was awesome. Loved it. By the time I left in 2005, I couldn't escape fast enough. That place, it totally transformed over that little more than a decade. And I guess all the people fleeing the sinking ship of California went north and continued to vote like Californians. But anyway.
You survived Seattle. Sweet.
I loved it. You know, that's just truly God's country up there. If you're an outdoorsman, the place is fantastic. And, you know, the mountains are so big and so vast. You know, you want to go camp and disappear and not see another sign of a human being? It's easy, you know. And more in our part of the world, that's a little harder to do. But
right.
That's
yep.
what I loved about it. But from there, moved back to Kentucky in 2005. And then I moved down to Tennessee about 7-8 years ago, and that's where I plan on staying forever. I'm totally in love with Tennessee.
I mean, I was
and
reading,
right now I live in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee, which is even better.
Well, I was reading your profile, and I'm like, holy cow! This guy is a flight instructor. He's a you fly. I think you fly for a living. If I'm not, am I a little right? Am I not?
Yeah, that was my transition out of the Navy.
Okay.
First job out of off active duty was flight instructing, and then I ended up doing some Part 135 charter, and then went to a turboprop airline out of Denver, and then went to a jet airline where I flew 4 or 5 different airliners over the course of the following decade. And then about 3 years ago, basically won the employment lottery and got a job with a great company based out of Knoxville. A cellular retailer, and this last
Sweet.
January, I basically took over the flight department when the last chief pilot retired. So now I'm the chief pilot there. So I'm actually sitting in Ogden, Utah right now. I've been doing job interviews all day long because we're opening a base out here. So yeah, my day job is still flying and managing a flight department,
and
but my real life is elsewhere.
In your motorcycle, you did some motorcycle racing, competitive shooting, hunting, fishing. Well, you're from Kentucky. You can't list things like hunting and fishing, hiking and camping. That's kind of like standard operation procedures there for someone
from
Kentucky.
Yeah, that's for the benefit of the New Yorker that reads that. You know?
Yeah, okay.
and through my airline career, I was based in Atlantic City, Newark, Chicago, O'Hare. I was based in all these places where I was a total, you know, oddball compared to all the local folks there, and I always got a kick out of exchanging our life stories.
Yeah, you should when people get on your plane, turn your hat sideways and start talking like, you know, some of the people in Kentucky.
when I was at the airlines, I did that. I was captain, so I'd be the guy making all the announcements, and if I was coming out of either Chicago or New York, I always made it a point to put on my thickest southern redneck accent that I possibly could, just to try to scare people to death. And then if somebody scare people to death that stereotyped us inappropriately, let me put it that way. And I'd have flight attendants calling up front on the phone telling me to quit because they were busting out laughing and they couldn't contain themselves because they were seeing the looks on people's faces, you know, and this big old rednecks making an announcement.
That's so funny. Oh, goodness. So you got a real job, but on the side you got this little hidden talent. When did you know that you would be a writer and wanted to write?
Never.
Never.
I wasn't. I'm not a literary person. You know, there's some people that actually, you know, have English degrees and stuff like that, and I always joke that I'm barely literate. But when I'd read a lot of books. So when I was in the Navy, I'd always buy, you know, kind of how-to books. I took a How to Paint Your Car book on a deployment with me when I came back. First thing I did was, you know, totally restored a Jeep from the ground up and painted it myself, you know, just from 6 months of staring at those books. So I was always into nonfiction and learning stuff from reading, but I never was into fiction.
And right.
In March of 2013, a good friend of mine recommended the book Patriot Dawn to me. And I was like, nah, I'm not into fiction. I just want to read to learn. He's like, you will learn if you read this. And he wouldn't let my lame excuses keep deflecting, you know, his recommendation. And so finally I bought the book and read it, and he was right. I was hooked, you know, and I just started plowing through, you know, Rawls and everybody else that was out at the time. In 2014, there really weren't that many people out. There was, you know, Chris Weather, Angry American, and the Rawls, and just a few others. And
right.
I started plowing through all those, and you know, I was an addict instantly. And in March of 2014, exactly 1 year after I read that book, and I can honestly say Patriot Dawn was the first fiction novel I read in my entire adult life. So in March of 2013, I read that book. In March of 2014, I published my first book. So just in less than 12 months from reading that first one. So I became an addict. And sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, you know, my next question was, and I think I know the answer, because you being from Kentucky, and I've never asked this of you, so this is just me guessing, but my next question I had down was, hey, you know, how did you get started prepping? But I think I know the answer. It's probably the same as Franklin Horton. Just you were just kind of...
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the stories of his, and me and Franklin are friends on the outside too.
Oh yeah, I know, yeah.
Not just from the writing thing, but we actually hang out in real life. But, you know, I'm sure if you're familiar with his books, you'll get the past of his grandfather. You know, and my grandparents were exactly the same way. They were you know, working in the coal mines at 12 years old, and just really hard lives from, you know, the Great Depression folks. And nothing ever went to waste. Even if they had later on in life, nothing ever went to waste. Everything was conserved. Everything was, you know, stored and saved, because they expected things to not continue to be prosperous, and especially in that part of the country. So you had the Great Depression era to Appalachia, and you had, you know, it was kind of double whammy. So you just kind of grow up that way. Everybody had a garden. Everybody had animals. Everybody went hunting. Everybody went fishing. It really wasn't a... let's learn all these life skills. It was just, that's just life. You know?
Right.
If you go back, you know, 100 years ago, and you look at your average person who stored food for the winter, you know, they had an apocalypse that was going to come every year when the winter came.
Right.
They didn't have stuff in their cellar, you know, to get through the winter. That was their apocalypse. So,
or firewood. Oh yeah. It was the way of
exactly.
life.
The firewood had to be stockpiled. The food had to be stockpiled. You had to be a prepper to survive, but you weren't called a prepper. You're just called a person.
Right.
Today, because of our infrastructure and our supply system that makes everything so comfy and everybody so, well, soft, essentially.
Yeah.
If you're the person that still does what people always did all throughout human history, you're the weirdo.
Yep. See, I'm from Appalachian Mountains as well, and in the mountains of North Carolina, and it was just a way of life. I mean, if you go up there even today and go, hey, did you know you're a prepper? And they'd look at you going, what the heck is that?
Yeah. I feel like I'm a prepper right now, just even if I wasn't into actual thing, how we all view it, just with the little farm thing. You know, my wife and I and our kids, we've pre-bugged out, you know, this job of mine allows me to basically work from anywhere. If I'm not in the airplane, I can do all my management stuff from home. So I only have to go to Knoxville when I got to fly. So there's times we'll go to the farm for 2 or 3 weeks and I'll never even come off the property. And so that life that we're living now, like right now, I'm looking at my first hay cut that's going to be, you know, in a week or two, and I'm looking, oh, okay, well, I limed this area, and I fertilized this area, and I weeded that, and I'm trying to calculate, okay, what's my production going to be, because when I go into the winter with 20 cows, I need X amount of, you know, X bales of hay just to survive the winter. So just like those folks did back then, I'm looking at that coming annual apocalypse, you know. So
yes.
Just living rural and living that kind of lifestyle where you're trying to be self-sufficient and raise your own meat and produce your own vegetables and all that kind of stuff, it's just, it's inherent, it's built in.
So you said, and you've said this before, I've heard you before, and you said the term pre-bugged out. What do you mean by that? And I mean, what exactly is that?
Well, you know, when my wife and I first got married, we lived in Knoxville, Tennessee, and it's essentially a city, even though it's Tennessee. And then we moved right outside the city limits to a place called Halls, but you're still, you know, right in the middle of everything, even if you're not in the city limits. And, you know, we felt more and more claustrophobic, more and more closed in as the area develops. And, you know, Tennessee's economically a growing state, you know, because we don't have any taxes and, you know, very low regulation. So there's a lot of business coming there, and there's a lot of growth. And if you're anywhere near a city, you're being overtaken rapidly. And we started thinking about, you know, just, well, the shit hits the fan scenario, you know, and being that close to everything. And when I got this job, my winning lottery ticket of a job where I don't have to physically go to work very often, that allowed us to move away. So we're an hour and a half outside of Knoxville in the absolute middle of nowhere. We're 45 minutes to the nearest store.
Right.
And we're up on the Cumberland Plateau. We've got a little farm. We've got our cattle. We've got chickens. We've got a fish pond that's just full of fish. We've got three creeks. Absolute middle of nowhere. You know, the neighbors are barely a rifle shot away, the closest one, you know. So it's, and, you know, Amish buggies would be our only traffic jam. So we're pre-bugged out in the sense that instead of living in the city and working Monday through Friday and then having a place that's 2 hours away that, you know, we hope to be able to get to if it all starts to fall apart, we just went ahead and moved. We're there.
Right. Sweet. In other words, you're ready at your current location for whatever happens. See, some of us, I tried that. My wife said she would leave me. Because we have kids, and you know, they're part of their school and the community, and it's just too
soon.
We're
having homeschool, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with it. And we got a 4-year-old and a 6.5-year-old, and we're homeschooling them because we are in the middle of nowhere, and there's a lot of homeschoolers up there in that area. So we've got a co-op that we're involved with. So the kids, you know, every Friday during the school year, we have this co-op at a Baptist church that's treated just like a school. They change classes. The kids are getting the experience of having classmates and having recess and, you know, having their lunch period and having all these different classes. But it's just, you know, the one day a week, and it's all like-minded parents. And it's amazing when we go to these things like the co-op and we start talking to people that live up there. There's so many people that used to live in cities and now they're on the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee. You know, and they still feel like they're not far enough away, even though we really are in the middle of nowhere. You know, and there's just so many people with the exact same mentality and the exact same uncomfort with where the world's going.
Yep. Yeah, that's good. You got some good neighbors. So I do have a couple questions for you here about your flying. So what is your EDC? And then I want to even jump that with, okay, since you travel a lot, you fly the plane yourself as a pilot, does your EDC differ than ours because you have privileges as a pilot, or are they the kind of the same, or how does that work?
Well, when I was an airline guy, anybody that's read my first series, starting with the last layover, the New Homefront series, you know, that was based on airline guys. So that was my fears at the time. I was FFTO. I'd gone to the Air Marshal School out in Artesia, New Mexico, and got deputized, and I was able to carry a gun on the plane. So that was basically my EDC in the airline world.
Yep.
And if you read that book and you read how those guys packed and what they packed in their suitcases and what clothes they took with them, that was exactly what I did every day. But you're limited. You couldn't even have a pocket knife. I could carry a gun, but I couldn't have a pocket knife. Couldn't have anything outside of the out of the letter of the law. Now, what I'm doing right now, it's called Part 91, which is owner-operated, so we're not for hire. Everybody that rides on the airplane is associated with our company. We're not renting seats or anything like that. So we're in a totally different set of regulations. So we don't go through security. So I carry a gun everywhere I go. And
gotcha.
I carry a backpack everywhere I go. And there's a lot of cases where we'll let's say we take a trip out west, you know, we do this Montana trip every year, and we do a Tahoe trip, and we do some other trips near some big mountains, the Rockies and stuff. And the other pilot, I mean, we're exactly the same. Matter of fact, he owns a farm 5 miles down the street from mine on the Cumberland Plateau.
Wow.
We're long distance hikers, you know, so we'll like to do 3 or 4 day hikes on a lot of these trips. So I've pulled my backpack out of the back of the airplane before with a big 7-inch barrel 357 Magnum on the side, hanging right on the side of it, you know, and our CEO just looks at it and laughs, you know. It's a totally different environment than if you're in a charter or airline kind of world.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
The plus two is that we're completely in control of our airplane. We're not subject to some airline deciding where the plane's going to go. If stuff was to start falling apart, our CEO is going to want to get home too. So
right.
Short
yep.
of the airspace being closed down, we're going to hop in the thing, fired up, and leave.
Gotcha. Sweet. So what, so have you ever, just because I got to ask this, scariest flight you ever had?
Driving to the airport in a hotel van. that's honest to God the closest I've ever came to dying in the airline
okay.
industry or the aviation industry was being in the back of a hotel van in New York or Chicago or someplace like
that's,
that and going to the airport. Because once you get in the airplane, you know, up high, you're miles from the traffic. Your separation is highly regulated. Everyone up past a certain altitude is a professional. You know, you've got amateur pilots down low, but not to say that an amateur pilot's not a good pilot, but, you know, there's a wide variety of experience levels and stuff. But if you're up in the upper 30s, 40,000-foot range, there's nobody up there but other professionals. And, you know, like I said, it's highly regulated airspace, and you just it's safe.
Sweet.
You know,
okay.
There's a reason the average death on a U.S. airliner every year is zero.
Gotcha.
There's nothing in this country that can say the average death is zero besides airline
right,
travel.
Exactly.
But for some reason,
yep.
people are afraid to fly, which makes no sense.
Yeah. I guess need for flying is the EDC and what I can take on there. So if I have an opportunity to drive to Florida instead of flying for work, I will usually get a rent a car and drive as opposed to flying, which my, you know, company would definitely offer for me to fly. But just being able to carry my gear is kind of more important than the quick travel time for myself.
Well, you know, you can, you know, and here's the thing about that. You know, there is only certain things you can have in your carry-on bag, obviously, you know. And so I wouldn't even go as far as to, you know, a lot of people like to take a full-size rollerboard suitcase that barely fits an oversized bin, and then they end up putting it 12 rows behind them, you know, because there's no space right over their seat. My philosophy for that is everything, obviously, with your gun and your knife, you know, that you will need in a hurry. You should have in a backpack that'll fit underneath the seat in front of you because you don't know what the situation is going to be if you
right.
have to deplane in a hurry. There may be a security situation. It may be an accident type environment where you need to be able just to – it's right there, grab it and go. You can't wait till 60 people behind you clear out of the way so you can get to the overhead bin where your bag is. So on board the plane, try to have something that'll fit underneath the seat in front of you that's got your immediate items that you need outside of – weapons, obviously. But, you know, in your check bag, if you're just worried about what's going to happen in the city you're going to and not necessarily during the flight or associated with the flight, you can carry a firearm. You can have pocket knives.
Right,
yep. You can have all that kind of stuff in your check bag. So there's really no reason to leave it behind. You know, just don't take your favorite, you know, safe queen of a pistol, you know.
Yes.
That's the one you're willing to get lost in luggage. You know, take the high point,
right.
maybe. You know.
Right. Oh.
But,
I don't want any high points, but yes, I agree with you. That's awesome.
That was an exaggeration, obviously. But,
yeah.
But, you know, as long as you're not going into New York or New Jersey or Chicago, you know, Chicago or California, one of these places where you find yourself in prison for the rest of your life for having a gun, there's really no reason to leave them home. You
see, that would be my luck.
Minutes dropping your bag off.
My luck would be I'd leave North Carolina to go to Florida, to Miami, and somehow we get diverted and go through New York, and I'd be in jail for the rest of my life, I guess.
Well, see, you know, and that actually happened when United was still Continental. Do you know that story?
Yeah, I did. That's what
the United. It was a Continental Pastures United now, and they were connecting through Newark, and they were going to Harrisburg, New Jersey, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And so they weren't supposed to actually stop in New Jersey. They got to New Jersey to Newark, and they had disconnected because it's Newark. Everything's late. Nothing's on time, right? So the airline gave them their bags back, put them up in hotels, and they had arrangements for them the next morning. But the guy comes back the next morning and hands his suitcase back in and redeclares his legally declared firearm. And what's New Jersey do? They snatch him and take him to prison. Now that we have the benefit of hindsight, we know if we found ourselves in that situation to refuse to take possession of our bag.
Right.
Yeah, so that guy, unfortunately, I mean, he didn't do anything wrong. No rational person could ever say he did something wrong, but New Jersey's not rational.
Yep. So I got a question. Tell me about this DD-12. I guess it's a new kind of thing that was created by LLA. I don't even know who created it, but I know that you guys are just tell me about DD-12.
It's the Dirty Dozen. And yes, Lisa Akers or LL Akers, her pen name. It was her brainchild. And here's the whole point of it, and it really does work. And there's so many of these fiction websites or prepper sites that may be focused on books and stuff. And what you end up having is you have hundreds of authors, and you never can have a personal relationship with people. You never can connect with people. You get these book links that people are plugging their book, and it's just this never-ending flow of links that just keeps flowing up the screen. Well, by limiting our author membership to 12, it narrows the focus of the group. So there's roughly 4,000 people on the Facebook page for the DD-12, and there's only 12 authors. So, and we all interact with these people constantly. And we meter out and we manage our own book announcements and our own book plugs, and so that we're not doing that same model. We're not just constantly going, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at my book, which is what you get in a lot of those other pages, because there's so many people involved. That's all somebody can do is just get their plug in, if they're lucky. So we do a lot more than that. We interact with people on a personal level. We get to know people. We make friends. We get involved in the conversations. There's a lot of, obviously we're all write the apocalyptic prepper type fiction. So there's a lot of fiction conversation or prepper conversation threads on there. And all 12 of us get involved in, communicating with the people directly and building relationships. So it's not just another, nameless, faceless thing. We're becoming friends with the reader group instead of, being held off at a distance. And a lot of us were friends in real life too. So we get along.
I'm sorry, you're friends with Horton and Angry American.
Those are my brothers.
I know they are. I know, and that's the cool thing about going to some of these shows too, like, Heritage Life Skills, Prepper Camp, and I know you guys travel, is that the readers get to go right there and talk to you, ask questions. And the cool thing about Heritage Life Skills, a person showed up that no one's probably ever met outside of just hearing his voice was Kevin Pierce. You're the guy that reads your audiobooks. And people were amazed. Awesome. They're like, that's the guy that reads all these books? So,
And Kevin's on board with the DD-12 thing too.
Yeah.
Because he's narrated so many of these books, he's developing a relationship with these readers. Now, how many times do readers get to actually have a conversation with the narrator for the audiobook? That's usually something that's way off in a distance, and you might know the guy's name, but that's about it. You're not going to sit and have a conversation with him. And he came to another event that me and Franklin and Angry American went to down in Jacksonville. He came down there and hung out with us for that too. So Kevin is a lot more than just your average narrator.
Oh yeah,
he really is part of the group, part of the team.
And it's so weird in this genre of prepping and crap hit the fan kind of books. I mean, no one knows who reads the books. I mean, Stephen King, no one knows who reads the books. But for some reason in this genre, everyone knows who he is because his voice, and he's really good. And it was cool because, you know, your fans, the readers could meet you. And then several times I said, well, I think it was Franklin Horton or maybe it had been you to go, well, here's the guy that read it when you listened to it. And the readers were like, whoa. And it was a cool experience. So if you ever do get a chance to go out to these shows, you know, you can go and meet these people. They're the real deal too. It's really cool. So also I like the idea of your DD12, Dirty Dozen 12, is you guys, I could read every one of Franklin Horton's books in two months. So what do I do the rest of the year?
Another thing. We can plug each other.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so you guys can spin off from each other, meaning, you know, hey, have you read these books? Have you read these books? Because you guys can only write so many books in a year.
You know, and we also include each other in our stories now, you know. I did some bad things to Franklin in my book Erebus, and me and Chris Weatherman and Boyd Craven and several others are in some of his other books, and I have a little birdie told me that we might show up in his next one.
We just get that
relationship, that camaraderie, and the readers that are close to us that, you know, they all read all of our stuff, and you know they've built this relationship with us. And when they go through reading this Franklin Horton book, and if they see my name in there, if they're reading one of my books and they see him in there, and I'm killing him off in some humiliating, embarrassing way, you know, that isn't in with us, it's just another character getting killed. But you know, to the people that are tight with us, you know, it's still bust out laughing right in the middle of a traumatic scene, you know, because we got that
right,
little
exactly.
Easter egg of a joke hidden in there.
So I've got a lot of the authors coming on. So I have Lisa Akers coming on. I got Boyd Craven coming on. I just enjoyed everyone's book so much that I read a lot. I read Random Acts from Franklin in less than like a week. And
I just did the audio book to that last week. That was a great book.
Yep. Yes. And you learn so much, even though that particular book is not like an end of days kind of, or, you know, crap hit
the
fan.
I call that a personal apocalypse.
Right. Yes, exactly.
You know, it still has that SHTF vibe to it. It's just it's not widespread. It's just focused on the one person.
It was a great book. I loved it. So you've been writing now, you've got, what did I count, like 10 books out? Is that?
I just finished number 11. It's not out yet.
Number 11. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a hardcore apocalyptic prepper, gritty, dirt, you know, grungy kind of thing. It's volume 3 of the Society Lost series.
So what book, I think you've already mentioned this. The book that influenced you the most for your writing and your writing style, or even also in your prepping, what book have you kind of like, man, that book there really changed on how I look, you know, how I personally prepare, and maybe also how I write as well. Is that the Dawn one?
Patriot Dawn had the biggest significant impact on me, not necessarily in a writing style kind of thing, because my writing style has evolved on its own. But because it put together that faction thing in my head, you know, the fact and the fiction melding together, you know, cause there was a lot of, you know, prepper and tactical type, nonfiction books that I was reading. And it's hard to, when you just read page after page of fact, sometimes it's hard to stay just, you know, focused like a laser beam on what's on the page. But when there's a story that you get involved with, and they use those same facts and tactics and skills, it's a lot easier for you to latch on, I think, and remember the things that are being used in the story. So I got that from Patriot Dawn, but my own writing style is just evolved on its own because, like I said, where I wasn't a trained professional writer, I just started writing. I wrote that first book on a cell phone on a Samsung Galaxy S4, just typing away with my thumbs. You know, it was totally just a random project. And then after people actually started buying it and liking it, I was like, ooh, I need to up my game a little bit and take this a little more seriously. And it, you know, I've evolved with each and every book, and especially that first series. A lot of people say they can see it, you know, a change in the writing style with every book, and I guess I'm proud of that. if I look at the newest book now, you know, I think I've kind of finally gotten the groove and nailed down who I am.
So, and you just said you just finished a book, is it just going through the process? Is it getting published, or how when is it coming out? And what's the title?
It's in the cleanup phase. The Tree of Penance is what it's called, and there's a true story behind that tree, and it's not
okay.
it's not a true publicized story. It's a true story that I know of from some things that happened in East Tennessee involving kind of the moonshining world, but it's not public story. So when people read what goes on with that tree, it's that kind of thing really happened. That's not just me trying to make up something that sounds crazy. But it's the third book in, like I said, the Society Lost series. And Society Lost series, to me, it's an apocalyptic Western. I'm a Western fanatic.
Okay.
I try to stay out of the prepper genre. I don't want to read what Franklin necessarily does or what Chris does or what Boyd does, because we all think too much alike. You know, if we're just sitting around having beers, you know, joking around, you know, if one of us pulls out an idea, the rest of us feels like, oh, now I can't use that because you said it first, you know? So if I don't read their books, I'm going to stick with my own original thoughts. I'm not going to accidentally pick up something from somebody else.
Have you guys ever thought about doing like a series kind of together, same characters, and they build and meet or something like that? Is that too crazy?
We actually have a comedy. Chris Weatherman, Angry American, Franklin Horton, and myself for two or three years now have been batting around a comedy, an apocalyptic comedy.
One's never been written.
Oh, it's hilarious, dude. It's hilarious.
Okay.
We'll be sitting around drinking beers and stuff, and that's where it really gets rolling, and we'll just sit there and throw ideas back and forth. And we always say that we'll have to have somebody that's sober in the room that can dictate so we can get it all down at once. But trust me, if we sit there, if I told you some of the stuff that we've came up with for it, you'd crack up laughing. But we basically make fun of ourselves, make fun of everybody else in the genre, make fun of so-called survival experts, you know, and basically everyone's fair game. You know, it's like a big roast.
Right. So, you know, I could see some comedy in my prepping career, I guess, because the first water filter I bought was one of them Canadine $350 water filters.
Dang.
And I know, and I'm like, you know, 5 years later, I'm like, gosh, that was I sold it on eBay as soon as I knew I got screwed by it. It was a nice one, but you can get them for $20.
Yeah, I've survived on those little Sawyer filters.
I know.
You know,
and
Have you tried those? Where you get them at Walmart for like $15?
Oh yeah, well, Sawyer is one of my sponsors. Yeah, I love Sawyer.
Yeah, let me throw a plug out there for them real quick. They literally have kept me alive before. There's a long distance hike me and the pilot I work with, Paul, did out in Northern California, just outside of Truckee around Tahoe, and we did this ridiculous trail that even the locals didn't do. We were around asking them, and I can't remember how many really tall ridges we crested and back down, and it's just a big elevation. You go up 2,000 feet, down 2,000 feet, up 2,000, and then you're at high altitude as it is, so it's all dry up there because it's California, and it's thin air. And we got to the lake that we wanted to end up at, and it was more like a climb down a mile long ladder to get down to it. It was just this boulder strewn cliff face that you had to use all your hands and your feet. You couldn't just walk, you know, it was like almost vertical. We get down there and we had a great time, and to pack back out, it was like straight up for several thousand feet, and we burned up every single drop of water we had getting out of that hole because it was physically exhausting humping a, you know, 50-pound pack in the middle of the summer. And so, but we're probably halfway up before we had exhausted all our water because we kept stopping, taking breaks, and we were trying to, you know, cut down the weight as it was. So when we finally got out of there, and we had a lot less water than we planned on getting out of there with, it was a long haul to get to the next spot where we could get some water because it's all dry, you know, it's arid California. And we finally got to this about the point where we started wondering when our bodies are going to start shutting down, where you actually start thinking those thoughts, not just I'm thirsty, I want a drink of water, but I'm not feeling right, things aren't working right, you know, I'm right. Starting to hit that point. We found this just muddy little trickle in this little ravine. It wasn't a creek or anything, and it was just barely enough moisture to do anything with. And we used the Sawyer, both of us just sat there for probably the next hour taking turns with my one little Sawyer filter sucking up every little drop that trickled down that little ravine until we were both completely rehydrated and, you know, threw our packs back on and kept going. And I'm pretty positive we wouldn't have, you know, been able to continue as far as we had to go to get to the next real water source if it wasn't for that little $15 filter in my pack.
Yeah, that is sweet. That's awesome. I mean, and see the one I bought was $329, and it weighed 10 times more than the Sawyer, and the Sawyer is much better. But that's a awesome story. I got to. So they sponsored the Carolina Preppers Network and the Prepping Academy, and we're actually giving away 10 of them right now when people sign up for our mailing list. But yes, yeah, Sawyer has been. It's never saved my life, but, you know, I can see one day that it will. But that's pretty awesome that you can did y'all suck out of the same – I mean, what did you do? Did you clean the nozzle, you know? Or did y'all just share the germs there a little bit?
Hey, man, when you're thirsty, you're thirsty.
Yeah, that's true.
You got bigger fish to fry at that point.
That is true. Oh, goodness. So have you has anyone approached you about a movie, or do you have any aspirations of getting one of your book series or one of your books into a movie format?
You know, the closest thing I think of mine that could become a movie would be Erebus. And that's because it's devoid of U.S. politics, because, you know, a lot of prepping stuff, and with most of my series, the government is kind of the root of the evil as far as to why there's a collapse. And there's exactly 50% of the country that would be completely opposed to everything I would say, you know.
Right.
But when I wrote Erebus, I wanted to make a story that a mainstream person could read and understand the importance of preparedness and, you know, survival and planning ahead and stuff without it being, you know, that kind of book that would turn them off. So that's why I used a sci-fi type scenario down in Antarctica. And the prepper in the book, he's a former Soviet Union type guy, so his mistrust of government comes from that root. So it's, you know, basically the same gist without having to talk about American partisan politics. So the guy had a mistrust for a good, valid reason, but Americans don't have to argue over whose fault it is, you know. And the funny thing is the character, which anybody that's read that book, Vasily, is based on a real guy that really was a prepper from behind the Iron Curtain in Antarctica in the fabrication shop. So
really?
It's not completely made up that there's a hardcore prepper in Antarctica that's actually from a, you know, comes from a real person.
But so it's basically a prepper book that's disguised as a mainstream sci-fi.
Yeah. So I was talking to Franklin the other day. Was it Franklin? Yeah, I think it was Franklin. And I asked him about the same question. I think it was through Facebook Messenger, to be honest with you, I think. Or it may have been text. And he asked me if I knew any. Oh, it was through text. Because I texted him when I finished reading his book, Random Acts, just telling him how much I liked it. I told him it needed to be made a movie. And he goes, well, if you know any.
That one could be a movie, yes.
Yes, it could. I told him I knew J.J. Abrams. And he's like, yeah, talk to him. I don't know him. You know, but that could definitely be a good movie. So, for sure.
Yeah, he'd have to take his love for guns and stuff out of it and his hatred of taxes because, you'd end up right there with the 50% of the country that would disagree with you from the beginning.
It's funny that these Hollywood people, they say they hate guns and they're against it, but every other movie, they got guns and shooting people, so.
They do, but they don't paint the picture of the flag-waving patriotic American
right.
with a gun being correct. it's used in a different context. But that whole, I need to protect myself and my family with a gun, it's my God-given constitutional right, that they don't agree with that perspective.
Yep. So what exactly do you have like an event in your mind or – What are you most nervous about, or I guess you could say prepping for? What do you think the most likely event would be happening that would allow us to utilize our skills?
an engineered slow spiraling decline. Basically what we see happening around us, even though Donald Trump was elected president and a lot of people might think, okay, Donald Trump's going to pull us out of this, you still see every day the deep state that's working hard against, his let's drain the swamp agenda. And so you've got this globalist deep state initiative that is just so embedded into everything, and it's over the, if you've paid attention at all over the past, decade or so, how can you not think that ultimately the path that the government is on is going to lead to something?
Right.
Some of the politicians might just be inept. Maybe they're just taking their payoffs and don't really care what's going to happen. But others very clearly have an agenda and a goal that they're driving towards. So whether it's, whether it's from corruption or incompetence or whether it's for just complicit, absolutely being complicit with it, it's not just a theoretical threat. We see it every day. So when you look at what's going on around the world with Europe and all the problems that they've got going on right now and the formerly wealthy countries in Central America like Venezuela that, socialism swept through, and look what's happened to those people. And then you look at the current generation of Americans and how they're being trained in high school. It's not just college anymore. It's on down to despise the Constitution and despise your rights. And it's how can you look into the future and think that that's not going to have some kind of negative impact?
Yeah, and I also think this slow, in the pot is one of the worst. It's one of the worst that could happen because you never know. And people like, near the city like myself, you don't know. It's hard to tell what the exact time is to bug out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes me the most nervous about the slow, or like a financial collapse or something like that. Next question is, do you think that you're actually having a positive, influence on your readers through the information you're providing in your book? Is that your goal, or is that just kind of just circumstances that, there is information they can learn from?
Well, it is a goal. And like I was talking about with Erebus a moment ago, I wanted people to see the need to be prepared and the need to be around someone who's prepared and who's thinking about you know, how to get out of certain situations and how to prepare and be ready for certain situations. And, you know, I most of the people that would read my other books, they already think just like I do. We all think alike. You know, we share information, and whether we're the reader or the author, most of us are on the same page. But with Erebus, I'm trying to reach out beyond that a little bit and get other people to see the need and the importance for being preparedness minded.
Gotcha.
You know, and when I was at the airlines and I was based in, you know, Chicago and Newark and all those other places, you know, there was a lot of people I worked with that weren't like-minded, and they would read my books just because they were mine. And there were a lot of those people that were woke up by it. A lot of them probably thought I was crazy, but you know, there was a lot of them that for the first time in their lives, they started looking at the system a little bit differently.
Right. Hey, well, we are coming to the end of our time. Guys, this is Stephen Bird. He's an author. He's a member of the Dirty Dozen 12. I've got the link in the description here, you know, to his books, to his website. Hey, Stephen, where are you going to be in the next few months? You going to any shows? Tell us everyone how they can get up with you and all that kind of stuff.
I'd say just, you know, find me through either the DD12 Facebook page or through, you know, my Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or just StephenCBird.com, either way, and just kind of keep up with me through there. The only events that I kind of guarantee that I'm going to do are the North Carolina events. You know, I love coming. I love the people over there. You guys are great. And I feel like, you know, like this last Heritage Life Skills, everybody that walks in the door, you know, I feel like I've met them two or three times already. And,
right.
And it's like a family. So those events over there, I'm guaranteed to do.
You can do Prepper Camp this year?
I'm planning on it, yeah.
Okay.
And it's basically the same group of people, you know. Same
right, yep.
Awesome North Carolinians. But I can't really plan a whole lot beyond that because I do have so much going on with whether it's the farm and all the stuff I got. That's basically a full-time job in itself, and then homeschooling and writing and then the flying job. So I try to do what I can, but the only things I can really guarantee myself are those local
Sweet.
Events like that.
Well, awesome. I look forward to seeing you, and I think it's September, end of September this year at Prepper Camp, and that's always a good event. I know Franklin's not going to be there.
Franklin's not, but Chad Rudolph.
I met Chad, yeah.
He's the DD-12er. He's coming to this Prepper Camp.
Actually, he's coming on my radio show on June 18th, so I'm going to have him on. So, Stephen, man, it is awesome. I know we've talked at all these shows, never interviewed you before, but what a great interview. E-U-R. And I'm putting your links on the description of the podcast. And hey, guys, go out and buy his books, read his books, support these authors that are spending their time to, you know, these guys don't make a fortune. If you notice, every author we have, they have a full-time job. So, I mean, they enjoy the writing. they enjoy the writing, and they're getting information. The information you get and you learn from some of these books could actually save your life. So, Stephen, appreciate you being on the show. Thanks for what you're doing, and we will have you on again for sure.
All right, thanks a bunch.
Yes, you take care.
All right, bye.
Okay, Stephen Bird, you got to get his books, guys. You got to support these authors, and you just got to do it. What a great guy! He is the real deal. He is, you know, I met him. He'll be at Prepper Camp. He just sits there in a chair, and you can go talk to him about his characters. It's really cool. Hey, don't forget about our giveaway. Go to Prepping Academy, Prepping with ING Academy.com. Sign up for our mailing list. We're giving away 10 Sawyer water filters. What a great story Stephen said about our sponsors. But we're giving away 10 mini water filters. You sign up for our newsletter, I think it's called. Just sign up, and then we'll send that out middle of next month. And again, Tenderfoot will be with us hopefully next week. If not, we'll have to there'll be some conspiracy theories, I'm sure, about that. But he texted me earlier. He was just with his family. They were at a movie when he texted me. So he's still alive. I have not eliminated him. I promise. People at my church would get a little upset. So again, preppingacademy.com. You guys have a great week. Next week, we're going to have on, before we get to go, is Lisa Akers. So we'll see you guys next time. Y'all take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Prepping Academy podcast. Preppers unite at www.preppingacademy.com.